Rilla Askew, thank you so much for coming in to visit with us at KGOU about your new book, Kind of Kin.
Thank you for having me here.
I finished the book just in advance of this interview, and I have to admit it was the first book I had read of yours. And when I was telling people that I was reading this new Rilla Askew book over and over again, first of all, they weren't surprised that it was good. And then I was surprised that I haven't read other books that you've written. So I apologize.
Well, never too late to start.
What prompted you to write this book, and how is it different from the other works you've done?
The first thing I'll answer is about what prompted it. And I found out, I learned about House Bill 1804, which is Oklahoma's anti-illegal immigration bill that was passed in 2007. I was here in Oklahoma at that time. In fact, I was teaching here at OU at that time and staying in Norman. And I began to read newspaper accounts and that it went into effect in November. And I was curious about it and in fact, disturbed by it. If we can put our minds back to 2007 to remember this was before Arizona passed its state anti-illegal immigration law. It was before Alabama, Georgia, other states followed suit. It was one of the first and at that time the most stringent in the nation. But because I had written about the Tulsa race riot, because I'm always writing about, you know, the coming together and the clash between cultures and races in Oklahoma, I was disturbed by the notion of a bill that makes it, for instance, a felony to harbor an illegal alien, which goes against some church people's belief about being sanctuary. So there's that notion. And so I was intrigued by it, but I hadn't really thought I would I think intrigued is not really quite the right word. I was disturbed, but I hadn't thought about writing about it. I was working on a different novel and had no intention of writing about it, although I do have a friend who was one of my former students here at OU, Armando Saleo, who's Mexican-American, who's also a fiction writer, a really wonderful emerging fiction writer. And I was going, Armando, you should write about this. This is like Grapes of Wrath. Somebody has to write about this. You really should write about this. But he had his own things to write about. So in February of 2008, after the bill had been in effect for a few months, I woke up one morning here in Norman at my friend's house where I stay when I'm here, Ann Masters, and I had this kid's voice talking in my head, which often books and stories start for me that way. And it was a child's voice, and he was quoting his aunt, and he said, your granddaddy's a felon. He's a felon and a Christian. He says he's a felon because he's a Christian. And I thought maybe that might be a short story. It just turned out to be a novel. So it unfolded. It wasn't as if I came up with the concept and said, oh, I'm going to go write about that. It was as if the voices started talking in my head and I followed them and had to abandon or put aside, I should say, the other book I was working on. I'll return to it later. So that's the answer to the first part of your question, but now I've already forgotten the second part of your question. How is it different?
Yeah, basically, yes. How is it different from, because you do address the issues and the intersection of the different cultures, and we have so many here in Oklahoma, actually. Mm,
yes. Well, the primary way it's different is that it's contemporary, because my other novels have been all historical. This one is an era I lived in and lived through and was writing it. In fact, the novel gets stuck in those same 3 weeks in 2008, and I was still writing it in 2011. I thought, this is going to be an historical novel by the time I get finished with it. So that's the primary way. It involved a different kind of research. And I also, which is that I went to the state capitol. I spoke with Oklahoma lawmakers who were incredibly helpful to me. And spent a lot of time, sort of showing me the insides about how laws get made in Oklahoma. They were very generous with their time. And so that was a different kind of research because that's nothing I knew anything about. But the details of everyday life and, you know, what kinds of cell phones people used in 2008 and what life is like in a little small town in southeastern Oklahoma, which is very similar to the small town of Red Oak where my parents live and where I spend all my summers as a child. That was not research. That was just knowing how it is, how a life is.
As an Oklahoma native, so much of the book rang true. That contemporary Oklahoma experience, at least for me, was captured just amazingly well. There were several people I thought I recognized.
Oh, I love to hear that. I mean, not as if they're thinly veiled portraits of people, but simply that there's some kind of authenticity to the Oklahoma character.
Yeah, there really was, and I know that you did talk to several lawmakers to learn about that process, and as a person who covers the legislature, thought you did that well too. Tell me about. I know you talked to State Representative Randy Terrell, who was mm-hmm. the author of the anti-illegal immigration legislation. Have you talked to him since the book? Has he seen
this? No, I don't know. I haven't spoken with him. And he spoke with me at the Capitol and, you know, told me he gave me an anecdote about how he came to come up with that legislation, which is nothing like the fictional lawmaker in the book. I do want to make that clear for readers and for Mr. Terrell that it's, you know, and in fact, he knew that I was writing a novel because the state representative from my area of southeastern Oklahoma, Brian Reniger, who's from McAllister, who also knows I'm not writing about him, introduced us and he mentioned what I was doing. And so we kind of joked around about it, and I made clear that I was making the state lawmaker a female and a, you know, and from an entirely different part of the state and so forth. And she has her own agenda fictionally in the novel that's nothing like what any actual person I spoke with about it. So although Jeannie McDaniel, who's a state representative from mm-hmm. Tulsa, she was at an event last night talking about this and about the book and saying that that I had captured the ins and outs and the sort of in interior intrigue and of how laws get made and what happens at the Capitol. So I was really happy to hear her say that. So even though the character's fictional, I hope that there's authenticity to what we understand of the process. I have to say that those lawmakers gave me way more information about that process, and I witnessed way more just by spending time at the Capitol and going to committee meetings and going to lunches and so forth than you could ever put in a novel. The reader's eyes would glaze over if you put all those details in a novel because what you're interested in is story, not just
the details and the process of lawmaking.
Yeah, not too many details. Yeah, otherwise you could just watch C-SPAN.
And listeners should know that this book obviously is not just about the legislature, but it primarily focuses on a woman's, you know, journey is kind of the typical word that's used, mm-hmm. but it really is a journey for her to, you know, find herself. I mean, she really does. By the end of the book, this, I don't want to give anything away, but Sweet, who's mm-hmm. the aunt that whose Destin nephew's was voice you heard, mm-hmm. Really is the central character in the book.
She is, and I did not expect that either. When I started writing in Dustin's voice, I thought that he would probably tell the whole story. And so I thought that I would speak about how – and I also, for listeners who don't know, this is not a Mexican-American family. It's an Anglo-American family who is primarily affected by the law. And so Dustin has the eyes of innocence and sort of like Huck Finn. I thought that would be how I would tell the story. But his aunt, Sweet, her nickname is – just sort of came in and took over the book. There are other voices in the book. There is the lawmaker's point of view. There's one undocumented worker named Luis, whose voice is also in the book, and Dustin's voice is in the book. But Sweet, she's the character who has the full narrative arc. You're right. She goes on a journey, an interior journey, and in a sense a spiritual journey and an emotional journey, certainly, because her father is the person who has been arrested and jailed in Latimer County for harboring undocumented workers in his barn. So this is the way he does this as what he considers his Christian duty. And she doesn't really understand why he's taking this stance, why he's doing what he's doing. And her life begins to fall apart because she feels like she has to take care of everything, including Dustin, who lives with his grandfather, who now needs someone to take care of him. Trying to hold her family together, and she's not sympathetic exactly to what her father's doing, but he's family. He's her father. She loves him. She knows he has a purpose for why he's doing what he does. So, she gets from here to there by the end of the book.
And she gets from here to there, but one of the things I appreciated in the way you wrote about her character and that journey was that her viewpoint was never truly harmonized with some of the others, like her father's, like mm-hmm. Dustin's, like her husband's. Mm-hmm. She really kept her own selfness, you know, her own person, even though she did change.
Yes, that's a very good way to put it. I like that phrase. I'm going to borrow that. Her point of view doesn't harmonize with the others. But I also think that the journey that she goes on is similar to what's happening with us as a nation. We're changing in terms of our point of view about the whole immigration issue, which is complicated. It's not easy. It's not simple. And when we look for simple solutions from one point of view or the other, we find that it's just too complicated to find an easy solution. There are, you know, millions of undocumented immigrants here, but they're completely woven into the fabric of our culture. They're intermarried. That's one of the elements in the book, which is that one of the reasons that this family gets involved is because there is a family member who's married to an undocumented worker. So undocumented worker, illegal alien, illegal immigrant, you know, we have lots of terms and we've never really come up with one that satisfies. They're, from one point of view, from against the law is against the law and they should all go back to their country of origin and get in line and do it legally, they are often called illegal aliens as if they're, you know, the other. And then people wanting to try to be polite will say undocumented worker, but that may be who it is and that may not be who it is. They're human beings. And so that's one of the things that we have to deal with as a nation, the fact that we're all affected by these issues. It's not simply the other. It is us.
Mm-hmm. And many, many others. And in mm-hmm. fact, one of Sweet's initial revelations in terms of her change in that attitude didn't come from the intermarriage, but actually came from a local Mexican restaurant that she liked.
Well, and wouldn't that be true for a lot of us? You know what? There are many things about this book, though the characters are imagined, the places are real. And and some of the stories that and the anecdotes that find their way into the book are real. And one of the stories that was told to me by some people from a small church congregation in the little town of Wilburton, where much of this action takes place in Latimer County, spoke to me about a fellow who worked at the local Mexican restaurant who was picked up for a driving infraction or some other reason. This after House Bill 1804 went into effect, his immigration status was checked. He was found to be here illegally. And so he was arrested and put in the Latimer County jail to be held for immigration to come get him. So, and this church, a small Methodist church in Wilburton congregation, they always went to Adelita's, the Mexican restaurant, for dinner after church on Sundays. They all met there. They all knew this fellow very, very well. They liked him. He was a part of the fabric of their lives. So he's going to be deported. He's actually from Central America, but they're going to deport him to Mexico. The church knows that, you know, but there's nothing they can do to stop the process. But the part of the story that was told to me that was so touching to me is how these church members all went in Latimer County. The jail is very small, and so to go visit the prisoners there, the people who are the inmates, you have to go visit, stand at a fence, stand outside.
So that fence that plays such a part in the book, it's real.
It's real, yeah.
Wow.
That's exactly how it is. It's on Sunday afternoon. There's a half an hour for the female prisoners and a half an hour visiting time for the male prisoners. So this little church congregation came and stood at the fence in the sleet and freezing rain and prayed with their friend, but there was nothing they could do. But for them, the compassion for who he is as a human being was what was dominant for them, not what his legal status is.
And I'm glad you brought up that story, because there's a significant religious arc through the book as well, and a mystical aspect too. Why was that important to put in here?
You know, when I was first thinking about this law, when it was first passed, one of the things that I felt perturbed by has to do with the fact that we as Oklahomans really consider ourselves strongly people of faith, religious. Most of the people I know here, I come from a strong Southern Baptist background. My daddy's a deacon. My grandpa was a deacon. I was raised in the church. And most people I know in Oklahoma, I would say the majority, really are people of faith, primarily Christian, primarily Protestant, and very often evangelical Christian, and how that comports with, you know, with this law that makes it, for instance, a felony to give sanctuary to someone who's undocumented. So, as I said, the voice I woke up with is, he's a felon and a Christian. He's a felon because he's a Christian. So it naturally had to, you know, bleed all the way through the book and inform the book. And I also wanted to talk about people who are like that little congregation I just mentioned. That's a factual congregation. But most of the people I know who are people of faith, even people who are not, you know, particularly religious, their hearts are good and they have a really powerful compassion. And for people that they know, for human beings, you know, for an abstraction, for somebody that's considered the other that they don't know as a human being, maybe not so much. But for people that they actually encounter, they'll go the second mile. They'll stop and help a stranger change a tire. So I wanted to address that, and I wanted to allow a different image of who Christians are than sometimes gets portrayed in the media, or it gets portrayed politically. I had a friend from the Northeast who read this book who sent me an email the other day saying, "You have just completely turned upside down my image of Baptists." and she meant that as a compliment, because she had a sort of one-dimensional view of who church members in a state like ours might be.
And one of the pivotal scenes in the book, it's clear that this idea of caring for the stranger, the sojourner, the traveler, is throughout the Hebrew and the Christian scriptures, and the local Baptist preacher basically discovers that I can't ignore this.
That's right. He starts to, you know, quote scripture about how to deal with the alien or the stranger. It's all about welcome the stranger. The alien among you, welcome him because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You know how it is. That was God's instruction to the Hebrews. And then Jesus said it. He said, you know, I was a stranger and you took me in. And elsewhere he says, you know, the man comes to him and says, what must I do to be saved? And he says, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul and all thy might. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Who is my neighbor? And then he tells the story. Jesus, in answering that story, tells the story of the Good Samaritan.
One of the things that happens to several of the characters along the way is they have this Southern Baptist background, or nominally Southern Baptist, I would say, and yet they take to lying, and this is kind of a big deal.
It's a big sin. Yeah,
it is.
It's a big sin. I was raised to think that lying was a pretty big sin. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, well, they do. They have they come out of a church background as I do. So the scenes that take place in the church, the ways even that the characters pray, it's influenced by what I know. But, they have a sort of a hierarchy of sin. And especially for the little boy, Dustin, he feels that lying is one of the worst sins that you can commit.
Yeah, because
he's been taught that by his grandfather.
Right, his grandfather really made that a big deal. When it comes to the mystical part of this too, in that Dustin has some mystical experiences, the illegal immigrant that he's with in part of the book has that too. Why is that in here? Why was that important to help move the story along, or how did that develop in your mind as you wrote?
That's a very interesting question, and I think I'm simply influenced by the people who first came and settled this land besides the nomadic American Indians who moved through here. Were the tribes who were removed here on the Trail of Tears and our great death march known as the Trail of Tears. They brought with them their spirituality. They brought with them their understanding that the world is spiritually ordered and that what we cannot see is as real as what we do see. And I feel that permeates our entire place here in Oklahoma. In my view, it permeates the world, but especially here. And so they brought their sorrows with them. They brought their spirituality with them. There was also very much engagement and remains very much engagement with Christianity among especially the five, as they're called, the civilized tribes, the tribes that were removed to eastern Oklahoma, to Indian Territory. So I think that that is in all of my work, and I think I can, you know, I don't escape it in my real life. I don't escape it in my work, nor would I want to. And I also think that there's, for people who are people of faith, we're always living in two realms. This everyday realm with the world and clamors and you know, politics and consumerism and all kinds of other things and weather.
Weather.
We live with a lot of weather.
Which plays a key role in the book, too.
Indeed. You can't have an Oklahoma novel without some weather in it, I think. And yet we're also attuned to what's true in the spirit. And in this book, there are three different modes of Christianity. There is Sweet's engagement is primarily with the Lord. She's always talking to the Lord in prayer, just sort of in an everyday way. Her father, Bob Brown's primary engagement is with Jesus. And so he talks to Jesus as a friend. And then Luis, who is the Mexican man, his primary engagement is with the Holy Mother, Our Lady of Guadalupe. So he's always talking to Mary. So, but they're all praying. They're praying in their everydayness. They're praying when they're in trouble, and they're praying when they're saying, oh, thank God.
I want you to read a little bit from the book for me. It kind of goes along with what we're talking about here on page 269, if you could just read that for me, and I have a question for you after you actually read that.
A man can know only the mistakes of the past, the decisions he would make differently if he could remake them. Never is there sufficient knowledge of the future to make the wise choices. What is there to rely on when a man must make choices? Protection and guidance from heaven? The blessings of the sacraments, if he is able to receive them? Prayers? Miracles and mercies? Faith?
Rilla, I ask you, the question I have for you based on that is, that seems like a theme for all the characters in this book, that regardless of the information they have or the situations they find themselves in, they're kind of making a guess as to about what they're going to do next.
Yes, that's true. And they rely on their faith to guide them all the time. And this is true for the people that I know, the people I'm closest to. They are always saying, well, I just don't know. I don't have enough information. So I'm just going to rely on my faith and on whichever higher power that particular person relies on. And it may be the creator. I have a lot of Indian friends for the name that they're going to give is the creator. I have other friends who are going to say Jesus. They're going to say Mary. They're going to say the Lord, Holy Father. You know, there are many ways that we reach out. But your perception of that, I mean, that's a great perception of, in terms of novel narrative, because the reader doesn't want to know what's going to happen next. But it's also just about how we live our lives, because we make assumptions about what the future is going to bring, and then life turns on a dime. Someone falls, a wreck happens, get a bad report back from the doctor. A plane hits the World Trade Center and everything changes.
There was one character I felt like in the book that did not believe that way. And it was the one that I think also had the most difficulty with the situation and where things were. And that was Misty Dawn Sweet's niece. For her, I always felt like she thought you should be able to make the right decision with the information you had and could not deal with this uncertainty about what to do next or where to go next.
How interesting. I've never thought of that, but now that you say it, I can certainly see it. And I think I was thinking of it more of the fact that she's simply young. And I think when she's in her 20s, she's got a very complicated life situation. And I think that when we're young, we do think that somebody's got to know the rules here, and somebody's got to have be able to make the right decision, and Misty Dunn doesn't ever think that she's going to be able to make the right decision, or that it's even her responsibility. She thinks her Aunt Sweet needs to make the right decision and fix things. And I think that what I was thinking of more is that it's how we approach life when we're young, and as we mature, we realize that we're never going to make all the we have too many mistakes behind us. We look back and say, well, I thought I knew what I was doing. Turns out we didn't. So maybe that's what I was thinking of.
And I admit, when I turned the last page, there were several questions that I had that I couldn't help but think, okay, I'm going to have her in the studio. Maybe she'll answer them for me. Tell me, okay, so what happens to Mr. Brown? What happens to the lawmaker who seems to be on the edge of falling apart? Are we going to see any of these characters return, or do you do that in your writing?
I haven't so far, but it would be interesting to see if they start talking to me again. I guess I'll have to see what happens in the next phase of their lives. The book is finished, and I think it's resolved, but it's not fixed. Everybody's at the end of the book. They've all been on a journey in some way. And we're still left in a kind of limbo, not that that where we really don't know where everyone's life is going to go, which is where I think we are as a nation, but I think especially particularly dealing with our politics and the immigration issue, it's not finished yet, and it's not going to be finished for a long time, and it's not going to be fixed, and there's not going to be simply one change in law that's going to resolve what has been a very long, complicated, and for many years neglected issue in our country that, people say it again and again. Our immigration system is broken, and it is. And when anyone who has an encounter with someone who tries to deal and wrestle with the entire system knows how broken the system is, how complicated it is, how frustrating it is, and how unfair it is. And on many, many levels. And so we're still waiting to see.
Rilla Askew, author of the new book, Kind of Kin. Again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.